You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. What makes a data breach the worst breach of all time? How about losing our social security numbers, the keys to our identities? How about losing 145 million of them? Breach is a podcast that takes you inside the world's biggest hacks, how they're done, who does them, and what's really at stake when your private data is compromised. And this season, they're investigating the worst breach ever. Equifax. Listen to Season 2 of Breach, the Equifax story. This time, it's personal. Subscribe to Breach, that's B-R-E-A-C-H, in your podcast app right now. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. If you had told Roger McNamee even 3 years ago that he would soon be devoting himself to stopping Facebook from destroying our democracy, he would have howled with laughter. He had mentored many tech leaders in his illustrious career as an investor, but few things had made him prouder or been better for his fund's bottom line than his early service to Mark Zuckerberg. Still a large shareholder in Facebook, he had every good reason to stay on the bright side, until he simply couldn't. Now he warns that the social media platform is a threat to democracy, privacy, competition, and even public health in his new book titled Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. And today, Roger comes on the podcast to discuss how he became an early mentor to Mark Zuckerberg, convincing the young mogul not to sell the company in 2006, and introducing him to the woman who would become Facebook's powerful number two, Sheryl Sandberg. He talks about the first warning signs that not all was well at Facebook and what happened when he brought his concerns to his old friends. He does a deep dive into the role that Facebook played in the 2016 election, how its algorithms are actually designed to polarize and spread disinformation, and how Russian trolls and companies like Cambridge Analytica were able to exploit those flaws. Roger shares how Facebook employs tricks from psychology and slot machines to keep us coming back for more, and why it may be a tough sell convincing people that some of their favorite features aren't good for them. Oh, and if you think Facebook is free, think again. He says you're paying for it with your personal data and even that of your friends and family. Coming up with Roger McNamee in just a moment. Roger McNamee has been a Silicon Valley investor for 35 years. He co-founded successful funds in venture, crossover, and private equity, including his most recent fund, Elevation, which he co-founded with U2's Bono. He's served as a technical advisor for seasons 2 through 5 of the HBO series Silicon Valley and was responsible for raising the money that created the Wikimedia Foundation. Roger was also a mentor to Mark Zuckerberg and an early investor in Facebook, but now he says he's lost faith in the company and its founder in a new book called Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. Roger McNamee, welcome to the podcast.
It's really good to be here.
Well, first of all, Roger, can you talk about your background in Silicon Sure. Valley and how you first came into contact with Mark Zuckerberg, or Zuck as you call him, way back in, 2006, huh?
So I first arrived as an investor in Silicon Valley in 1982. And wow. If you've ever seen the movie Apollo,
did it exist back then?
If you've ever seen the movie Apollo 13, this was the Apollo era of Silicon Valley, where
yeah.
the government was still the primary customer. You know, the space shuttle was the hot thing going on. There were also defense electronics and all. The personal computer industry was in its earliest days and hadn't really become a thing yet. So I was lucky enough to be there when all of that began. And it happened that I was a musician. Helped to support myself in school by playing happy hours. And it turned out that the people who started the personal computer industry were all my age. We liked the same music. We liked the same things. And so I got welcomed into this thing in this really weird way because I knew like 200 songs and nobody else knew more than a few songs and no more than a verse and a chorus. So I wind up getting folded into the business early on. I learned the industry. In those days, I was at T. Rowe Price in mutual funds. I was the tech analyst. I was lucky enough to start the first day of the bull market of 1982 and had this glorious ride. I started my first firm inside the venture firm of Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers, the people who then in the 90s went on to finance Netscape and Google and Amazon. Yeah. So I was really, a little bit like Zelig or Forrest Gump. I was sort of in the right place at the right time over and over again.
It sounds like it. Tell us about your first meeting with Mark Zuckerberg. How did that come together?
So in 2006, Facebook is 2 years old. They just finished a year with $9 million in revenues, which was mostly display ads for like pizza parlors and things. It was really not a business yet. They didn't even have news feed. They just were a Facebook. It was picture and your address and all that kind of stuff. It was only available to college and high school students. And I get an email from a senior executive there who says, my boss has a crisis. He needs to talk to an old hand who can be objective, but also, private, not share it. It's a really serious problem. So Mark Zuckerberg comes to my office. And what you have to understand is I just started Elevation with Bono. And one of our partners, John Riccitiello, had been the president of Electronic Arts, the video game company. So we had one conference room dedicated to video games. And it was soundproofed because we had this giant stereo and giant TV and all these video game machines. And, people wanted to play them during the day. It would just completely distract the office. And so it was totally soundproof. So he and I are meeting in this thing. It's set up like a living room. And I say, Mark, before you say anything to me, I got to give you some background because once you start talking, you'll think that everything I say is affected by that. And I said, look, if it hasn't already happened, either Microsoft or Yahoo is going to offer $1 billion for Facebook, which, of course, would have been an outrageous number. And everybody you know is going to tell you to take it. Everybody, your parents, the board of directors, all your management team. And they're going to tell you they'll fund your next thing and you'll have $650 million so you can change the world. And I said, dude, all of that is true, but I think Facebook's really special. I think even at 2 years old, even at this tiny little thing, you have this idea and you've married it to two things that I think really matter. Authenticated identity. Because you had to come from a school, you had to be authenticated. And what that meant was that they weren't going to have a troll problem, not the way that yeah. MySpace and Friendster and even AOL had. Anonymity bred trolls. And they gave people real control of privacy. And I thought that was going to create trust, which was really going to be important. So I was convinced it was going to be as big as Google was at that time, which, there weren't very many people who thought that. Well, they're a private little tiny company. Yeah. And he was 22 years old, right? It's not like people are looking for companies backed by 22-year-olds.
Right. In those early days, Wall Street and Silicon Valley were still trying to figure out where the value was in social media. So what was your advice to him in that meeting?
I just said, look, if you sell the company, whoever buys it's going to wreck it. And I just think if you believe in this dream, you should go for it. It took me about 2 minutes to say that. What followed that was amazing. I've just laid this really heavy thing on him, and I'm thinking, okay, well, he's going to come back at me. We're going to have a real conversation. Instead, total silence. And he goes through these thinker poses, hand on chin, hand on forehead, look up to the right, look up to the left. At the one-minute mark, I'm thinking to myself, wow, he's really thinking about this. This is like, I'm used to people not listening. This is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But pretty quickly, I realized this is actually very weird. At the 2-minute mark, I'm going, this is really weird. At the 3-minute mark, I'm getting really uncomfortable and my fingernails are starting to carve into the furniture. At 4 minutes, I'm ready to scream.
Yeah.
And it's sometime in the minute after that, he finally relaxes because he's been trying to decide, does he trust me?
Interesting. Okay.
And he basically goes, that's why I'm here. You won't believe this, but everything you just predicted has just happened. How did you know? And I go, I didn't know. I just know the people. I've been here for a long time, for 24 years, and I just know how Silicon Valley works. And I just said, so the right question is, do you want to sell the company? He said, well, everybody wants me to. And I said, well, that's not what I asked. I said, do you want? He said, no. And I said, well, let me help you teach them why they shouldn't do it, because this is really special, and you'll never be able to create anything this cool again.
And that first meeting ended up turning into a long-term mentorship, huh?
That meeting took half an hour. He really appreciated the input. He doesn't sell the company. He goes home and he invites me to come visit the following week. And that begins a 3-year period where from 2006 to 2009, I meet with him at least every month and sometimes multiple times a month. And his problem was that once his management team said they wanted to sell the company, he needed a new management team because they obviously didn't believe in the vision. What I wind up doing is helping him with all the management issues.
Right. And in particular, your other key contribution to Facebook's success was that you introduced Zuck to Sheryl Sandberg. How did that happen?
In 1999, I was helping my favorite rock and roll band, the Grateful Dead, deal with keeping 60 employees who'd worked on their tour for, at that point, 30 years, and they didn't have a tour because Jerry Garcia was dead. They were trying to support everybody by selling merchandise over the web, and some guy brings them a real estate deal, and I didn't know anything about real estate, but I was helping him essentially take the technology that they had and syndicate it so that every band could join in, use their infrastructure to sell directly to their fans. It was a great thing for bands. U2 finds out about this, and Bono wants to learn about it. Because, you know, I've been talking to American bands, Dave Matthews and Pearl Jam and, you know, Fish and Bob Dylan and, you know, all sorts of people. But U2 finds about it. And so Bono is at that time, in 1999, working with the U.S. Treasury Department to arrange forgiveness of debt from third world countries that would never pay it back. Africa, Asia, South America. The woman he's working with is Sheryl Sandberg, chief of staff to the Secretary of the Treasury. And she says, wait a minute, I know who that guy is. My brother-in-law, her sister's husband, works for him. So she connects me to Bono. Bono and I become partners. So when Mark's looking to get a new number two, I get this phone call from Sheryl saying, hey, you know, I'm ready to leave Google and I've got this opportunity to be like the number two person at the Washington Post. I'm going, Sheryl, are you insane? The Washington Post, I mean, you're getting killed by Google. That'll never work. Don't do that. You should go to work at Facebook. And she goes, wait a minute, he's 23. I can't go to work there. And then I call Mark and I go, hey, Mark, I think you should hire Sheryl Sandberg. And he goes, she works at Google. Like somehow that's a problem, right? And I'm going, hang on. Yeah. He goes, it's nothing like Facebook. I'm going, no kidding, but what's closer? Anyway, I talked to her. I explained to her that Mark's mom is a doctor and he only has sisters. I think he's going to be cool with a woman. I talk to Mark and go, hang on, Sheryl's the most brilliant executive I've met in years. She's going to be good for you. They finally get together. It turns out marriage made heaven. So the two things I did for Mark were helping him find a way to keep the company independent and then introducing him to Sheryl.
And without those two contributions of yours, who knows if Mark would even have the company today? And he almost certainly wouldn't be one of the 5 richest people in the country. So when was it that you felt that Facebook was in pretty good hands and your job as a mentor was done?
So I'm super, super proud of the company.
Yeah.
And in 2009, it becomes pretty obvious that they don't need me anymore. The thing I'm good at is the early stage stuff. So I'm pulling back and I'm just I'm a cheerleader, right?
Yeah.
Totally love it.
So then when at that point did you start to sour on the company?
I didn't. I'm blissfully unaware that there are issues. I mean, there were a couple of really important signals. And candidly, I didn't make the right connections. And I get really angry at myself because I'm an analyst and my job is to make weird connections. And there were a few signals, but I missed them. The truth is that the original design was brilliant and the people were really smart. And the incredible thing is how long it took before real problems became obvious. Mm-hmm. So it's 2016, and I've actually retired from the investment management business. The culture of Silicon Valley is changing in ways I didn't like. And I thought Facebook was the exception to the rule, that they were the one that wasn't on the bad culture. Naive me.
Was it the election that woke you up to this, or what was the turning point for you?
2016, I noticed a series of things. First, in the New Hampshire primary, you know, essentially people using a Facebook group to post really malicious political content and spending, it appeared they were spending money to get friends of mine to join this group. And I'm going, why would somebody do that? And then there was a thing related to Black Lives Matter where massive violations of civil rights of people who expressed an interest in Black Lives Matter done by a company using Facebook's advertising tools to gather the data. And I'm going, wow, that's huge civil rights violation. Then the UK has a vote on the Brexit referendum in June of 2016. Yeah. And I look at that and I go, what if that outcome was influenced by Facebook? What if it was possible that Facebook's advertising tools allow campaigns with a really malicious, nasty, fearful message, which is what Leave had? They were blaming everything on immigrants. And I said, what if that gave you an advantage? What if that stuff was more viral? Because there was at least, I already knew there was at least some conditions where that might be true. Mm-hmm. And then in August of 2018, first we hear about Manafort, and then the Housing and Urban Development cites Facebook because their advertising tools allowed for discrimination in housing. And that becomes public in October. And I write an opinion piece for a tech blog called Recode. And I basically say, there's something wrong with Facebook's business model and algorithm. It's allowing bad guys to hurt good guys using the same tools that make the advertising so effective.
But you didn't publish that op-ed, did you? What did you do instead?
Instead of publishing it, I send it to Mark and Cheryl.
And how did they react?
Well, I mean, they reacted the way I would have expected, which was to say they got back to me right away. But they go, Roger, nothing to see here. This is not a systemic problem with our business model. These are just isolated things. We've taken care of it. But we value your opinion, and we're going to hand you off to one of our colleagues, a guy you know really well, and you guys can figure it out. And so this is October 30th. The next few days, I'm talking to this guy, Dan Rose, and we have these conversations going, Roger, the law is really clear. We're a platform, not a media company. We're not responsible for what third parties do. And I'm Dan.
That's how internet companies get away with everything.
Well, and I'm going, Dan, I don't think that's right. Then the election happens, and I go completely ballistic. And I go, dude, you sitting there and saying the law protects you, but Facebook is about trust. And if the people don't trust what they see on Facebook, if they don't trust your motivations, the law can't protect you. Yeah. I think you need to do what Johnson & Johnson did when that dude poisoned bottles of Tylenol.
They recalled them all, didn't they?
Exactly. They took them all off the shelves. But what they did was they said they were going to protect their customer. Mm-hmm. What they did was they said, we're going to bear a financial cost. They didn't put the poison in there, but they said, these are our customers. We're going to protect them. And in the process, they built this massive trust. It was worth so much more than what it cost them. And I thought Facebook could do something like that. And it would do that by cooperating with the government, giving them access to all the data, figuring out exactly what happened, then warning all the users of Facebook who were touched by interference and saying, you are touched by interference, right? Here's what it was. This looked real to you. It looked authentic, but it wasn't. We missed it. We're really sorry. Okay. I thought that was the right answer. I spent 3 months trying to persuade him. And it's like, He couldn't have been more polite, but it was also, I didn't move him even a millimeter. And so I finally give up. And that's when I realized I didn't understand it well enough. I needed to find allies. And I start searching. And I first find a guy named Tristan Harris. And I learn all kinds of things.
Well, I want to go back to what you were talking about how Facebook creates this fertile environment for this sort of thing. You point to the financial incentives and the algorithms on Facebook that are really, I guess, designed so that they push people to political extremes and amplify disinformation over actual information.
Yeah.
So why? Where's the value in that to Facebook?
In early 2016, I don't know any of this. I learned it in April of 2017, when I meet a man named Tristan Harris, who comes out of Google, who is an expert in persuasive technology. And he's on 60 Minutes talking about what he called brain hacking, which is the science of persuasive technology. If you put it on a smartphone, so it's available on people's bodies all the time, you basically tease them with rewards that get them to come back. Because if you're selling an ad, if you're Facebook or you're Google and you're trying to get people to pay attention to ads, it's not like on TV. You can't interrupt the programming. It's got to be kind of in line, and otherwise people zone it out. So,
right. So
you need them to see a lot of ads. They need to see the ad over and over. So you need them to both come back a lot and then spend a long time. And what they figured out was they could use likes. They could use notifications. They could use tagging from photographs and things like that to get you to come back. And then when you are back, they appeal to the lizard brain, to fear and outrage. Why? You say, well, why not just do happiness? Well, it turns out that one person's happiness can be somebody else's, can be cause jealousy or resentment. Whereas when you're afraid or you're outraged, you share what makes you afraid or outraged, because if other people share that with you, that makes you feel better. That's the way you make yourself feel better. And there's an analogy in disinformation, which is that essentially there's something that causes to be drawn to things that are more outrageous, and disinformation can be more outrageous. And so at the end of the day, MIT has done a study that says that disinformation goes 70% further and 6 times faster than fact. And humans do that, and we all do it, and we can't really help it.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it just Facebook that uses these engagement tactics, or do other online companies do it as well?
Google has done this, so it's Facebook, Instagram, to a lesser extent WhatsApp, then Google, YouTube, to a lesser extent Twitter, and Snapchat all have this problem. And the basic notion is they're trying to manipulate our attention. And in doing so, with these great advertising tools that make them so much money, they essentially give advertisers the ability to manipulate our time and our attention. And in doing so, a bad actor can manipulate what you think. And that's what the Russians did in 2016. And that's what all kinds of bad people have done around the world. And I mean, I didn't know any of this until I met Tristan. And when I learned it was like, oh my God, how did I miss this? I mean, I felt so stupid. And in the book,
yeah, it is alarming.
I write the book as though I'm Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window. Although somebody pointed out maybe I'm Howard Beale in Network, but whatever it is, I'm ignorant at the beginning. Yeah. And I take you on the journey with me. And the thing is, you don't need to know anything about technology to understand this stuff. And I don't bury you in it. What I do instead is I give you the context to understand enough of the history, enough of the culture, so you can see what's different about technology today.
Yeah, what happened? Because technology and the internet used to be these good things that were improving our lives and bringing people together. What was the turning point?
It didn't used to be this way. For 50 years, tech was nothing but good, warm, fuzzy, beautiful, empowering stuff.
Right.
And it's only recently that now we are in this really kind of predatory, it's more like an oil business where they're extracting value from us without giving us a benefit in return.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're giving us a benefit, but it's unrelated to the extraction they're doing. And, when I learned this, I was horrified, because it's like, I helped to create this thing, and I realized I've really got to devote myself to trying to make people aware of the problem and help guide them through it. And the book is an attempt to do that.
And you talk about filter bubbles and preference bubbles and how they come into play in this context. It sounds like it's almost a case that once you get it going, it just becomes self-perpetuating.
It's so true. So if you think about this, there's always been some degree of polarization in the world. And there have always been some people who believe the earth is flat.
Right. I think you say 40%.
Well, no, in
Facebook,
the old days, it was maybe 5 or 10,
right?
And what's happened is that social media, because they profit, because internet platforms in general profit from spreading disinformation, conspiracy theories, and things that make you afraid or outraged, the percentage of the population that believes things that are just demonstrably not true is like 40%. And if you think about it, science is on the human impact on climate change is indisputable at this point. And yet a third of the country denies it. And if you look at things like the connection between vaccines and autism, the original so-called science was made up and there's literally no connection. Mm-hmm. And those two things together get you to 40% because there's almost no overlap, and that's not including flat Earth and all the other things.
Right,
and I'm going,
right. Okay,
but the point is it doesn't matter what the number is. What matters is how do you have a functioning democracy if you can't agree on the facts? Because I look at this and say, if the facts are stable, we can have a different point of view of what to do about them. That's politics, and that's good. And that's why I say to people, this is not an issue of left versus right. This is an issue of right versus wrong.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Roger McNamee when we come back in just a minute. It happens to the best of us. Right before a big deadline, or just when you're printing handouts for a key presentation, the printer runs out of ink. Then you have to go through that expensive hassle of replacing the ink cartridges. Thankfully, with an internal ink storage tank, larger ink cartridges, and an intelligent page gauge that displays ink levels, Brother Inkvestment Tank printers can literally change the way you ink. Brother Inkvestment Tank Color Inkjet All-in-1 printers deliver ultra convenience along with a low cost per page and an affordable upfront price. Enjoy uninterrupted printing with your choice of up to 1 or 2 years of ink included in box. Inkvestment Tank printers can keep your business running while delivering super functionality, including print, copy, scan, and fax. With Inkvestment Tank, there's no sweating over your printer running out of ink, just the features, convenience, reliability, and affordability you need. Learn more at changethewayyouink.com and get ready to change the way you ink. If there's something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals, BetterHelp Online Counseling can help. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, anxiety, relationships, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. And get help at your own time and at your own pace. Anything you share is confidential. And it's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions as well as chat and text with your therapist. If for some reason you're not happy with your counselor, though, you can request a new one at any time for no additional charge. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/kick. Then simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/kick. And now, back to the podcast. And then, of course, you have the Cambridge Analytica breach, which speaks to your concerns about how Facebook treats user data. Can you explain exactly how much information Cambridge Analytica was able to access and how they put it to use to manipulate voters?
Cambridge Analytica was a company created in the United States out of an English company. Okay, so the English company, SCL, was in the business of what they called psychographics, which was determining certain personality types and how they could be manipulated in an election context, right? But it was very clearly about manipulation. And so in order to be involved in a U.S. election, you can't be involved if you're a foreign country company. So they had to create a U.S. subsidiary called Cambridge Analytica. And their basic idea was they went and hired a researcher at Cambridge University in England, and he took advantage of a program that Facebook had that allowed an application on Facebook platform to – if you got, in this case, he got 270,000 people to fill out a survey, and it was a personality test. And the way the Facebook thing worked was if you did that, you could get access to the entire friends list and all the data about those friends. So the 270,000 people gave them, they had a total of 87 million people they captured information on, 50 million of them were Americans. 30 million of them, they captured so much data, they knew everything there was to know. Cambridge Analytica, basically, if you sit there and say 131 million people voted in the 2016 election, there are like 220 million registered voters.
Right, if they're in the right states.
But hang on, but they got
all the difference.
They got 30 million out of 220.
Yeah.
I mean, they've already got this incredibly high resolution view of the whole country. Mm-hmm. They tied it to voter files. So they knew exactly where everybody lived and they knew their voting history. So they tie that to the Facebook user ID. Then the next step in the strategy was you then go and craft very specific ads. And this was the genius. This was not something the Russians did. Because what the Russians did was use the Facebook ad tools to basically undermine our faith in democracy. Mm-hmm. That was their strategy.
Right.
And they inadvertently contributed to getting President Trump nominated by the Republicans. And obviously they hacked the Democratic National Committee, Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. They worked with WikiLeaks. They did a lot of things to affect the election. But what Cambridge Analytica did was totally separate. And they were working inside the Trump campaign. And they had all this data. And it was tied. So they imagine they have basically one in seven American registered voters. They have everything that's known about them. From that, using the Facebook advertising tools, they didn't have to have Trump say to people, you need to follow me because I believe in X, Y, or Z. They said they identified for each candidate what their emotional weak spot was.
Oh, wow.
And the primary goal, I believe, and I can't prove this, but this is my hypothesis, their goal was to actually suppress votes because we're so polarized. The notion of switching somebody from one party to the other is very hard. But the notion, they said they went after white suburban women, people of color, and idealistic young people, basically the people like Bernie Sanders.
Uh-huh. And their goal, nihilism.
And their goal was to suppress all
matter.
The votes. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so they would find the thing in the people in those buckets. And they're starting with this giant set, right? And then they could identify people who are physically co-located because they're going to have similar philosophies because people live near people who agree with them.
Right.
And so it was – I mean, nobody knows what the impact was. But what it proved was that in an election context, products like Facebook and Instagram can be used to manipulate people without them being aware of it. Mm-hmm. That's a bad thing for democracy. I'm sitting here going, look, I don't want to relitigate 2016. What I want to do is protect future elections. And so what my team did was to try to get Congress to engage both sides and recognize that any country can do what the Russians did and any party, any person can do what Cambridge Analytica did. And nobody should be allowed to do that. I mean, President Obama did something that was – not as cynical as what Cambridge Analytica did, but they did something that used many of the same techniques, and it shouldn't have been legal for them either. Mm. Okay, I just don't think I think that we want elections to be about rational, informed debate. Right? There are real issues in the country. We should be talking about that. We shouldn't be figuring out if you're afraid of, you know, alligators, and then saying the other guy's going to put an alligator in your kitchen.
To your broader point about how these companies like Facebook use personal data, it seems like the public either doesn't have a concept of what's going on or why they should be concerned. In fact, it almost seems like people have a certain attitude that they're not paying for this service, so they're fine with this unspoken agreement that their data is the currency with which they access these quote-unquote free platforms like Facebook and Google. So how do we get people to take more ownership over their own data and an active role in protecting their own privacy?
Technology has advanced in ways that we haven't had a chance to catch up to. And if we think about this in the sense of data and privacy, everybody says,
right,
Roger, my data's out there. I can't get it back. That's true. And they say, and I'm a good guy, so I got nothing to worry about. And I go, well, you may be a good guy, but you have a lot to worry about. There's a thing called a behavioral surplus. And this is a technical term that's used to describe the things that data tells us, not about you, but about the people you know and people who are like you.
Even people who aren't on Facebook, right?
This is absolutely correct. And so what's going on now is that data that we used to allow to be shared because it didn't matter. So think about this, like it used to be okay to share your financial data, credit card data, mortgage data, and all that, because basically it was only used by people to make your life better. But now it's being used to construct this really detailed image of you that may be used to affect other people's lives and provide no benefit to you at all. And the same thing is true of geolocation data. So your cellular company will sell anonymized geolocation data, but anybody like Google or Facebook who knows your movements on the web can figure out which one is you, and then they tie it to your financial data, and you don't even need to be on there, and they know exactly who you are. And what I say to people is the problem with all this data is that the game has changed. I think we need to ask some questions again that we haven't asked for 30, 40, 50 years. Like, why is it that people are allowed to sell our financial data.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not obvious to me that that's a good idea at all.
Yeah,
why are they
yeah.
allowed to sell our geolocation data? Why are they allowed to gather and sell data about minors?
Now, every time Facebook is caught violating users' privacy or manipulating the information they read, Mark Zuckerberg usually gets off the hook by simply saying, "Sorry, we'll do better next time." Why has that been enough to keep regulators off their back so far?
I think the real reason is that for 50 years, technology just made our lives better. Mm-hmm. So we had learned to trust it. And from a regulator point of view, the people who use Facebook love it. And for really good reason. I love Facebook. I mean,
right.
I love sharing pictures. I love, you know, seeing what my friends are up to.
Wait, so you're on Facebook
yeah.
yourself even now?
I have to be because, okay. I mean, first of all, I got a band, okay. my rock and roll band. We built our entire community on Facebook, so I'm kind of stuck.
Okay.
But not only that, I just wrote a book called Zucked, where my target audience are people who are on Facebook and Instagram.
Right.
And I want to reach them.
You haven't been banned since you published the book?
No.
Okay.
But I will say they've had a few moments where they thought about it. They've
oh, really?
Quite off. Yeah, no, they've banned individual things and then unbanned them.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Wow. But that's okay.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I totally get all that stuff. And so what I have done, though, is I've stopped using Google.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was struggling. You know, Google has a million different products, right? They got search, they got maps, they got email, they've got, you know, they've got applications, you know, they have all these different things. And I thought to myself, in the future, Google's going to be a lot scarier than Facebook because mm-hmm. they're all over artificial intelligence. They're all over, you know, these smart devices like Alexa and Google Home and, you know, because even in Alexa things, they use the Google Android operating system. And that stuff is terrifying to me. You know, letting something that's listening all the time into your house is terrifying. Into your bedroom is insane. These things are incredibly hackable.
Yeah.
You know, they're made by Chinese companies that our government tells us to be very afraid of. You know, there's lots of reasons not to let that stuff happen. So I was very afraid of Google. I turned it into a video game. You remember Frogger? You know, you're the frog. You got to hop across the river by going across logs. So Google for me is the river.
Okay.
And I use the DuckDuckGo search engine. I use Ghostery to block tracking bits that people use to track me around the web.
Yeah.
I use the Apple Safari browser. Browser. I use Apple Maps. I use Microsoft email. I use Microsoft application software. I use 1Password to log on to everything. And I play this game. My high score is 2 months. When
really?
I fail, it's almost always for the same reason. I'm on the web. I'm looking up a restaurant, and I inadvertently hit the map,
and it's
a Google map, and I'm back in the river. But the thing I would say to people is we have so much more power than we realize.
Mm-hmm. Well, how much of the problem is the corporate culture at companies like Google and Facebook, and how does that play into how they address or in many cases don't address these problems?
I started looking at Facebook, but this problem is way bigger than Facebook, and it's really the whole data economy. So it's internet platforms like Facebook, which owns Instagram and WhatsApp. It's internet platforms like Google, which owns, you know, YouTube and a bunch of other things. It's Snapchat, Twitter, but it's also the credit card processors who sell your data. It's the cellular companies who sell your data. It's, you know, the data brokers who sell your data. There is a lot of people we need to be thinking about here. And the culture of these guys is really similar to the culture in the whole economy, which is for 38 years, we've been deregulating and letting things just happen. And for a long time, that worked out really well. But now we're in this place where all the power is built up in a really small number of hands. And it's time to start to share the benefits of the economy with everybody. If I could magically wave a wand and, you know, give both Mark Zuckerberg and Larry and Sergey, the founders of Google, the opportunity to have a good night's sleep and wake up and have an epiphany in the morning, I just would want them to understand, guys, you won, right? You know, you could start a foundation, try to save the world, but it'd be a lot more powerful if you did it by fixing your companies, right?
Okay, yeah.
Right?
True.
Go to the source of the problem.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not expecting that to happen. I'm always hopeful. So what I want us to do is the rest of us just sit there and do the same thing that teachers in Los Angeles did, the same thing that teachers did in other parts of the country, the same thing the air traffic controllers did, which is to say, you know what? what's going on here isn't right. It isn't fair. It's not in the national interest. And we have a lot of power. Let's just flex a little bit and see how it feels and see what happens. And I'm super optimistic. And I just want to thank you for giving me a chance to share with your listeners.
My pleasure.
Because this stuff really does matter. And we can
for
do
sure.
this. I can just tell you, I know 2 years ago, nobody was listening. And now everybody kind of knows there's a problem. We're still trying to figure out how it affects us. We're still trying to figure out what to do about it. I'm still looking for answers. But what I know and what I've written in the book is that there's a lot of things we know now that you can learn real quickly.
Yeah.
And some of them will work for you. Some of them may not. That's fine. Don't do those. But we can make this work.
Okay. So you haven't gone full dystopian on technology yet. You're still hopeful for the future?
I'm really optimistic about the future. 2 years ago, I couldn't get anybody to talk to me about this. And now, every day, there's another big story. In the United Kingdom, they just put out this monster 18-month research report from the government that says, you know, that accuses Facebook of being digital gangsters, right? In Germany, they've passed a law to prohibit the kind of many of the behaviors that Facebook takes standard. You know, the European Union has gone after Google for antitrust violations. There's a lot going on. And here in the United States, California has passed, you know, a really, really important privacy law. And so we're beginning to make progress. So I'm very optimistic. And we as individuals, we can change our behavior. You don't have to abandon the platforms entirely. Just don't live your whole life in them. You know, take one thing off at a time and work with friends. Protect your kids. Recognize that the initial idea of exposing kids all the time to technology is not a good idea. You don't, except for special needs kids, you don't want computers in the classroom. You want the kids focused on the teacher, learning to work with each other. Have the computers at home. You know, you don't want your teenage kids to be subjected to bullying on Instagram. You don't, you know, there are all these things that are out there that you want kids playing outdoors. You want to have play dates that are device free. You want to make it socially acceptable for people to daydream, to be bored, right? Because that's actually really healthy stuff.
Here's the thing, Roger. People like Facebook, and they especially like these bells and whistles such as the likes feature and notifications. How do you convince them that those aren't very good for them or that there might be necessary changes that have to be made to the platform, but ones that at least in the short term, they're probably not going to like very much?
Well, I don't have to convince everybody at once. People walk into a McDonald's or into an In-N-Out Burger and they see the four kids at the table who aren't even talking to each other. They're using texting to each other. And, you know, you go and meet a kid and they can't make eye contact. People are aware that there's issues now. And they want to do better. And the whole point of my book is to, first of all, teach you how to think about the problems and then give you little things that you can do. You don't need to do everything at once. It's really all about recognizing that there are issues and then doing it together.
Yeah.
You know, forming a book club of parents, you know, so that it's okay for your kids to go play outdoors instead of being on the computer all the time, right? This is a social thing. We're going to do this as a group, right? And my point to everybody is, hang on, I did this my entire career. I didn't figure it out all at once. You don't have to figure it out all at once either. This is really about we're going to do this together. And we do have a lot of power to affect change because we can go to our elected representatives. They know change has to happen. They're actually, you know, contrary to what people think, Congress really is getting this very quickly. Because 2 years ago, they didn't know they were supposed to. And in less than 2 years, basically in 18 months, they've gone from not even thinking about it to having really thoughtful ideas about what to do about it. And again, we still have polarization, so we have to work on more people. But that's my job. Yeah. What I'm saying to everybody is just do this with your friends. Do this with your kids.
Sure.
It's going to be okay.
Well, you've also been active in lobbying Congress to take action to protect users, specifically with regard to the political disinformation campaigns and polarization on social media. What would you suggest? Should social media companies be treated the same as broadcast media and required to give equal time to both sides?
I think that's a really tough call, and I don't know the answer to that specific one. I'm doing really well on both sides of the aisle. I think people really do view this as right versus wrong, not right versus left. I believe that what's going to happen is we're going to go after specific uses like this issue of financial data or this issue of geolocation data. We're going to go after protecting kids. We're going to go after creating a legal recourse. Think about it as the bad stuff that's happening is no longer little. It's really huge. And it's like a toxic digital spill. Analogy being a chemical spill. And the people who create those spills have to be responsible for cleaning them up. And that's the piece that's missing. That kind of regulation, I think everybody's bought in on that, right? Mm-hmm. And I think antitrust isn't about being negative. It's about making it possible for alternative models to get started up. It's about promoting the American dream of innovation and in entrepreneurship.
Right. And but so, how do you make an antitrust case out of this? Because competition usually involves price fixing and that sort of thing. How do you apply that?
In this particular case, it turns out that the thing that people forgot is that in economics, just because something doesn't have a currency price, just because you're not trading dollars for it, doesn't mean there isn't a price. What this is a barter. You're giving up your personal data in exchange for services. The problem with the deal is that you're getting no benefit at all for the behavioral surplus, for the portion of your data that's being used to affect the lives of other people.
Okay.
That is effectively a price increase. So the value the other side is getting is rising geometrically, and the value you're getting isn't rising at all. And that is an unfair deal. Like so much in our economy today, most people are not getting the benefits, right? In our economy, the problem we have today is a small number of people are getting all the incremental benefits. And that's what's going on here. And I've been working with economists and with legal scholars to turn all of this into a thing that the Federal Trade Commission and the Justice Department can use, again, to create space. We want to keep what's great about Facebook. We want to keep what's great about Google. What we want them to do is to have incentives to change their business model. And I think the notion that people who've been harmed can litigate against them, that doesn't require a bureaucracy. It doesn't require overhead. That's the American way. You settle disputes in a court. And the scale of these things is so large that it's just like chemical spills in that you can't expect society to always bear the cost and you get to keep all the profit. I mean, that's not fair.
Well, I know you have to go real quickly. You want to plug your band?
Yeah, so I also play in a bunch of rock and roll bands, but the one is called Moon Alice. If you go to moonalice.com,
okay.
We play all over, mostly the West Coast, but we play in California. We play in Oregon, play in Arizona, sometimes Colorado. And I play in a band called the Doobie Decibel System, which is ddsband.com. That's tight vocal harmonies. Sometimes it's a duo, sometimes a trio, sometimes a band. And then I play solo under Roger McNamee.
Wow.
And I love playing music, and I would just say to everybody who goes out there, you know, the best part of this whole experience for me was I used to let technology mediate most of my relationships. And I lost touch with a lot of people that I really cared about because I just talked to them on email or texting or something.
Yeah.
Or Facebook.
Yeah, you're not alone.
And I've spent the last year consciously reaching out to people that I love and just saying, hey, would you like to have lunch? And I can tell you,
for you,
I don't know how many people out there could possibly have been more addicted than me. I had at one time 7 mobile devices on my belt. I looked like Batman. And I mean, I was really over the top. And I'm not cured because from addiction, you're never cured. But I'm enjoying my life because all these wonderful people are back in it. And you and I are here today. We're having a real interaction, right? Face to face.
Yeah, and, imagine that.
But if you guys could be here with us, his office has got all these amazing magic posters and books about, I love magic. And I knew the names of all of these magicians from the turn of the century in the early 10s and 20s. And it's like,
that's unusual.
Well, but I'm just saying, I've now found somebody I would like to stay in touch with because
we
have an interest completely unrelated to what we're talking about here. And I know way less than he does about magic. And I'm always looking to learn more.
Well, we'll have to do that. And once again, the book is called Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. Roger McNamee, thanks for talking with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Roger McNamee for coming on the podcast. Order his book, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And follow Roger on Facebook or on Twitter at Moon Alice. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient, you can schedule secure video and phone sessions as well as chat and text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kickass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. One more time, that's betterhelp.com/kick. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at KickassNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kickass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.